Hey, Internet. I'm Mark. He's John. This is the Enthusiasticast, the web show where we always recommend an awesome book. This week, I'm enthusiastic about In the Place of Justice by Wilbert Rito. But first, John, I wanted to chat about literary video games. L.A. Noir, it's like being advertised on the side of a bus near you, I'm sure. Came out a few weeks ago. It's just the latest in a small but growing number of video games with ties to the reading world, I think. And I think that that's exciting. The problem, of course, is that you don't play video games, do you? I don't think. So,
no.
This can be a short conversation, maybe. I don't know. Unless you formed an opinion or something about the interactive fiction links that I sent you last week. What I want to know is, does mixing games with your reads hold any interest to you at all?
It kind of doesn't, but I think that that's totally to do with me and not to do with the idea of interactive fiction or game fiction or any of these things. I'm just not a gamer. I never have been a gamer for as long as I can remember. I've had friends who were gamers. The closest I came was I did some role-playing games with some friends, back in high school for like about a year, and then that kind of fizzled, and I just never followed up on it. And then years later, what I realized was that I just like hanging out with people and eating snacks. And so now I just play poker, which I guess is a game, right? But it's, you know, a means to an end. What I think of as like as real gaming, I can't do. And I don't know if it's because I'm lazy. I just can't be bothered to muster the effort. Most of the entertainments that I enjoy seem to really be passive experiences, you know, movies, TV shows, music, books, comics, right? They're all things where, you know, here is the experience. You just show up and it's all there and all the heavy lifting has been done for you and you just have to consume it, right? I'm a consumer. I did look at some of those links that you sent me the other day. I finally got Digital Love Story working. And for those that don't know, it's this really, I've never seen anything like it. And I was really super interested in the setup for it, right? So it's basically, you know, you download it and you are somebody who has just got an Amiga, an Atari Amiga. It was Atari, right? Back in 1988. And the person who set up the computer for you has given you a number for a bulletin board, an online bulletin board, a BBS to go and log on to. And so when you do that, it kicks off the story whereby just replying to all of these messages, you get sucked into all of this stuff. One of the threads of which is a love story. And so I was quote unquote playing that for a little while, but I don't know if you said this, but I did find it dissociative because at the same time that I was the one replying to all of the messages and I was the one doing things, my responses were set up. I didn't get to see my own responses. I would just hit reply and then the people would reply to me as if I had said something, and then I would have to infer from what they said what I had said, but I didn't know what I had said. So I'm like, I don't know who I am. I'm having an identity crisis. It's like, am I witty? Am I charming? Am I smart? Am I a loser? Who am I in this story? And so I ran out of time and I just didn't have a huge impetus to come back to it. Also, I feel like, and I didn't get far into it enough to judge, but there was nothing about the storylines as they had presented themselves or the characters as they had presented themselves that made me want to come back to it in the way that a good first chapter, a good couple of first chapters of a novel, or a good first 10 minutes of a movie will hook me. But again, I feel like they're chalk and cheese. I feel like they're two different things, even though they share some elements. Like you said, the L.A. Noir video game has, these elements of narrative. And, from what little I've read about these things, you can affect the course of the narrative. It's not like Super Mario Brothers where, you know, you run through the thing and there's a flag at the end, and there's always a flag at the end and it's always the same course, right? You know, these games, they can go different ways, more of a choose your own adventure style thing. But I think as soon as you introduce that element of interactivity, you fundamentally change the basis of the relationship with the work, and not necessarily in a way that's objectively good or bad, right? It's different from what I generally like. We talked way, way back in the day about Clay Shirky and his TED Talk about Gen Television and Social Surplus. And he says a lot of awesome things in that, and I think people should go and check it out if they don't know it already, because they'll find it really interesting and entertaining. But one of the things he said in that was that we're moving away from this passive relationship with our media. Specifically, he was talking about television, but it could apply to a lot of media, and moving into a more interactive and a more social arena where that kind of relationship with our media is going to be more prevalent and even dominant. And I'm actually kind of worried now that it might leave me behind, because apparently, like, I'm an old school 1950s media kind of guy. I, you know, I like it laid out for me, and then I just show up and eat it. Those are basically all the thoughts that I have, though, about.
But so it wasn't the Chrome and the fact that you had to click on stuff that you found distracting. It was the fact that the impetus was on you to act.
Yeah, well, and there was just that sense of, this sounds stupid, but I didn't know if I was, you know, if I was doing the right thing. I fumbled about. It's set up like an Amiga. So, you know, even the interface was completely foreign to me. I never had an Amiga. I had a Texas Instruments 99-4A because I was having the wrong computers even back then. Even that, I found that there was barriers to entry, right? Huh. You know, I click on the TV, I know how to do it. You know, I open a book, I know how to do it.
Choose Your Own Adventures, though? Were you ever into those?
No, not super. I loved it because the company that makes those is called ChooseCo. And I'm just like, that's a great name for a company. And they're still going. They still make those books. But I would always try to die, because I thought the deaths were the most interesting parts of the Choose Your Own Adventures, right? So I'm just running around, you know, playing the anti-Darwinist and just choosing the dumbest. You know, do you run towards the salivating roar? I totally do. Going down that hallway. Eaten by a plant.
Well, I'm.
Are you a gamer?
I'm just stoked about this area, right? Like, from the indies through the majors, I was a big choose your own adventure guy. And so, like, I'm not thrown by the kind of constrained autonomy thing at all. Like, I'm happy there, right? And so, you know, that is to say, well, there is, like, a conflict between kind of the story creator and the participant, but my feeling is that that's gradually just going to become more background noise. Right, like over time, just as more technology comes on board. We both read Freedom, right? And so in Freedom, if you remember, there's that fictionalized interactive story that runs throughout it. Like, the main character of that story has this, like, stripped down hero's journey that's, like, just a bit of a meta narrative, and then all the side stories kind of happen looped in around it. Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, so it's just like he's got this, like, very basic, bare bones, like, through line, and then everyone else kind of congregates around him. And I thought that was, like, really cool. And you could almost do that today, right? Like, you could, not as a video game, but as, like, a location-based story on your iPhone, you could have, like, one trunk story with all these side stories branching off that actual participants, like, work into. You know what I mean?
Well, a lot of massive multiplayer online role-playing games seem to function on that same principle, right?
Exactly.
I don't play MMORPGs, but from what I know about how they function, take the DCU one, which just launched recently, right? There's a through narrative for the world, which is going on it with, you know, Superman and Batman and Lex Luthor and whatever. And you're not those guys. You're one of like the remora fish, right? That are just hanging around the edges, and you're having your story in the wake of all of that stuff. And every now and again, your story will intersect, and then it will veer off again. So absolutely, that format is.
I bring up the Freedom TM example because that does, like, on your phone, the technology just kind of comes transparent, and right. It's not like you're going to a place to like log on and experience this world. It's the world that you live in, and the phone you always have with you. So in that way, experiencing the narrative, like the tools to experience the narrative, just kind of disappear.
So you're right. Okay, so you're basically, the story is sort of coming to you on your phone.
Right, and when we get to that point, I really think we're going to have like this breakthrough kind of auteur, like Bonnie and Clyde type moment where just like the French New Wave goes mainstream kind of thing, you know, where it's just like you're going to have like a decade of great auteur indie game authors essentially bringing story after story. I just can't wait for this.
Well, once it goes onto the phone too, because that's so integrated into people's lives, we're kind of cyborgian with our phones as it is right now. But also the phone, because it's app based, does so many things other than just text, right? So you could integrate all of it. You could integrate, you know, GPS. You could integrate the weather. You could integrate whatever you want. And make it really immersive and portable and easy to use. I'm totally not against this. I get that this is the future. I can see it coming. I mean, and obviously given the popularity just of straight gaming, right? I mean, it's a bigger industry than the movie industry. I think it's on par or even bigger than the porn industry, which is, you know, one of those sort of shadow numbers that you always hear, right? That like way more money gets spent on... you know, on the red light internet than on the regular internet. And so obviously this is connecting with so many people, and it's just only going to evolve. And I really look forward to stronger narrative structures, right? Not necessarily more defined narrative structures, but more narrative, you know, just in the evolution of video games, right? It used to be a ball that you bounce back and forth between two paddles. There was no story. And now it's all story-based, and you've got, you know, professional story editors and screenwriters and novelists working on the narrative of all of these games. So I can't wait until everything has a narrative.
You can't wait until your teenagers get into it.
And then teach me how to do it.
Exactly. Okay, so let's
do this book, man.
Yeah, so my pick is inspired by Shawshank Redemption. So we were talking a few episodes ago about Stephen King's Different Seasons, yep. And that inspired me to go and dig out Wilbert Rideau's 2010 memoir, In the Place of Justice, which I had bought when it came out. And it was just sitting on my shelf. So, Rideau's story is kind of crazy, actually. But in a line, like in just a simple strap line, well, it's not that simple, but imagine the John Coffey character from The Green Mile. Have you seen that movie?
Yep. I read that as a serialized novel before it was collected.
Oh, hey. And then the Red character from Shawshank.
Right, okay.
The Morgan Freeman character in the movie.
Right.
So imagine that they are the same person, a real person, who, like, never got out of jail and can write a mean sentence.
Okay.
And that guy is Wilbert Rideau.
So is he still in jail?
He's not.
Is that blowing the ending?
No, it's on the jacket.
I'm assuming you know that from, like, the jacket copy.
Yeah. So this isn't bleak Oz kind of prison stuff, but it is a memoir about doing time. So, you know, it's not for everybody. I'm not going to shy away from that. But it's really great. It's like it's great in unexpected and surprising ways. So Rito, he's black, right? So he kills a white woman in Louisiana in 1961.
So this is established. He confesses to doing this.
He does.
Okay, so it's not one of these stories where he's trying to prove his innocence or anything like that. Like, up from the get-go, he's actually a criminal who has been justly convicted.
Yeah, he basically confesses. He says, you know, I didn't mean to shoot this lady. It happened. I'm sorry. You know, and that's where it starts.
Right.
But he's like 19 at the time, and this is 1961. So what's happening in Louisiana in 1961, right? Like, To Kill a Mockingbird was written in 1960.
Wow.
Right? 1962 is the Gregory Peck movie, right? 1961 is in that sweet spot of all of that stuff. And, like, the night he's arrested, there's, like, 300 white guys at midnight in front of the police station waiting for the police to pull up with him.
Right.
Right? And it's, like, it's going to be a lynching, you know? Like, it's, like, right out of... It's right out of that the Ku Klux Klan playbook, right? So he gets the death sentence, and really at issue is whether or not it's there's premeditation. Whether or not there's premeditation in the whole thing, but basically, bam, you know, he's going to fry.
Is that right? The difference? Is that the legal distinction between first and second degree murder is premeditation?
No, premeditation is the difference between murder and manslaughter.
And manslaughter, okay.
Yeah. So yeah, they're gonna like light him up in the electric chair, and he is shipped off to prison. He's 19. His life's over, kind of thing. So 12 years go by, and he goes from like the local lockup, to Louisiana State Prison at Angola. I don't know if you've ever heard of Angola before, but it's called The Farm. It's
okay.
Nicknamed The Farm because it's on an old plantation in Louisiana. The fact that he's a killer basically saves his life in one of these small ironies of things.
Because it gives him a rep, gives him...
No, because it puts him on death row. Right? So the fact that he, like, if he was going to go into the general prison population at 19, he would have been eaten alive, right? So especially in the early 1960s, right? So he basically stays on death row until 1972. And at that point, the Supreme Court of the United States basically changes all death row sentences in the state to life in prison. Like, it has nothing to do with him. It's just like an interpretation of the law has been rewritten. So his death sentence gets commuted to life in prison. And at that point, 12 years later, he then enters the general prison population.
Right.
And that's where, so at that point he teaches, so he's got like a eighth grade education, and he teaches himself how to, write, basically. He takes up journalism, and he is eventually made the editor of the prison newspaper.
Okay. How long does that take, or is that, again, sort of spoiling the twists and turns?
It doesn't take that long after, like, so he's let out, he's reintegrated in 1972, and I think he becomes the editor of the paper in, like, 75.
Oh, okay.
So not like a terrible amount of time, but it's still, like, you know, it's still, like, the black man given a position of responsibility in the prison, right?
Right.
And so...
So is it a fairly mixed prison population? Is it predominantly white or black? Like,
Well, it's...
Is there a lot of racial politics, like, within the prison?
Oh, yeah. Big time. Yeah. It's like, this is Vietnam era, right? Like,
right.
It's big time. It's a big powder keg. And so, so when he first gets to Angola, they have about, I don't know, about 2,000 inmates. And they have, like 50 guards or whatever. Right. And the guards have indentured other prisoners to be guards.
Right.
So like there's like a whole hierarchy of power within the prisoners as well. Because some of them are armed.
Holy shit.
If that makes any sense.
Right? Not really, but I understand what you're saying.
So that eventually gets abolished and they staff up. But like, you know, in the 60s, they didn't want to pay to have, anyway. So Rito becomes the editor of the prison newspaper. And what happens next is kind of remarkable, actually. He builds the newspaper into this like award-winning journalistic institution that like wins awards around the world. If this makes any sense,
just on a level playing field, like he's competing against the New York Times, you know?
Yeah.
Like. It, you know, these aren't awards for prison newspapers.
No. He wins. They won the George Polk Award. Have you ever heard of the George Polk Award?
I have.
The newspaper has won like the. It's never won the Pulitzer, but it's like it's won a litany of awards. Wow. So basically, he shows up. He's made the editor. And the warden says, like, okay, you know, we used to censor you before, but we're not going to do that anymore. You're basically free to write what you want. He's like, you know, this is America. We have press freedom here to, you know, check the powerful. And that's going to be no different in prison. We will have a free press in this prison so that abuses and stuff is kept in order. Right? Like, so this white guy.
I was going to say, who's this warden? Because he sounds pretty radical.
He is crazy radical. And he basically takes Wilbert aside and he's just like, listen, you know, here's carte blanche. You're only governed by the truth kind of thing. Right? So this is like unprecedented. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard of the riots at Attica, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So like 43 inmates were killed in Attica in 1971. The California penal system's exploding. And here you have like Wilbert Rito, a black man in Louisiana, basically going all like Walter Cronkite from within Louisiana State Prison, right?
Amazing.
So at this point, the paper is like smuggled out of the prison. Like, you know, drugs and weapons are being smuggled in, but this newspaper is being smuggled out and it's finding its way into the mailboxes of people like Stephen King. Right? So, yeah. So like through the late 70s, he is breaking taboo after taboo about prison life, right? Like he wrote an award-winning story on prison rape, and like it's basically like none of this information had ever seen the light of day before,
right?
And so it was crazy.
What's the framing device for this? Like, how is this narrative told? Is it like him telling you the story as an older man, and is he framing it like, you know, I'm going to show you the end and then I'm going to take you back and show you the beginning and this is how I got here kind of thing?
It's a personal narrative. So it basically, you know, he talks about his childhood. He talks about his father. He talks about being a teenager in Louisiana. All this prison stuff that I'm telling you is really just background. It's more of a personal story.
Okay.
About so
what, like his relationships or?
Well, so the mid-80s come along, right? And he's done 25 years at this point. So he's reformed, he's respected, he's clearly not a threat to society. But they, you know, he talks about all these guys that he went in with, and they're either released or they're dead, right? Like, 25 years is a long time.
It is.
But they won't let him out. And so parole hearing after parole hearing comes and goes, and he's denied every time. And he's like, right? Like, the New York Times and the people are writing about him, and he's getting awards, and he's able to leave prison on, like, day parole unaccompanied to give speeches to, like, to kids about going wrong in your life, right? And they won't let him out of prison. So he really should have been let out in, like, 83, 84. He gets out in 2005.
Oh, my God. What's that, 44 years?
He does 44 years. He's, like, the longest-serving prisoner. Well, actually, that's probably not true, but... But 44 years is
but
what like...
But he's a 63-year-old man. They just wait until he was like...
Infirm. Oh, no. No, no, no. They in 2005, it wasn't like, dude, it's now your time. They didn't want to let him out in 2005 either.
And is that just like, listen, we said life, we meant it. You know, we're happy that you're...
No, not at all. Right? So like he has this line in this interview that I saw online of him in 84 or whatever, and he's just like, I've been in here longer than 99.9% of people in this institution. And then they don't let him out for another 22 years. Right? Like, it's crazy. It's crazy what happened to this guy. So, it's like... At that, like, you know, there's like the story of the crime, the story of him going to prison, all this like racial politics stuff. But like when he gets to the part where he's like clearly getting fucked over, that's when the story just kind of turned and became kind of unexpected and kind of like surprisingly. You know, like, I was in a criminal justice class in university, and the professor, who's a criminologist, came in, and he's just like, so I've spent lots of time in, you know, working with prisoners in the penal institution, and you know how prison is in the movies? That's exactly how it is in real life, right?
Really?
And, well, that's what he said to the lecture hall, right? And so... I was expecting that this would like check all the boxes of the stereotypes, but it's really a personal memoir.
And right.
It's really about his. It's really about him, right? As you would expect with a memoir, I guess. But
right. And does he look around him though? Even as he obviously is no longer a threat to society, and even as you know he is like stymied and frustrated by this bureaucracy or you know whatever it is that's keeping him, does he acknowledge and look around at like the other prisoners and go, no, most of these guys really should be here. Like it's you know, it's just me who like what are does he deal with sort of the bigger issues of prison and prison reform and how prisons work or how prisons don't work? Or is it just, you know, through the lens of, you know, his specific case? Does he blow that up to like a macro at any point?
He does. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it's what it's really like to be in a slammer, right? Like that's part of it. And then there's this part of him that's like that his story, which is kind of like uplifting and amazing in a positive, kind of unexpected way, because he's just like doing some decent living. And then there's the bigger macro stuff about institutional politics and the kind of reform, the prison bias, I guess, in the U.S. Right. And like, by the time he gets to really late in his sentence, like the warden, the last warden that he has to deal with is just like a caricature. It's kind of crazy. He's like the boss hog of prison wardens. and it's like, wow, right? Like this guy's for real, right? And talks about how religion has become a big thing in prison culture now and stuff. So there is a look at other things. It's a really well balanced book, actually.
Well, obviously, this guy's a journalist, right? So, and he's an award-winning journalist. So, I mean, he's going to bring that clear and objective eye to it, right?
Yeah, and he's like a really just like homespun, down-to-earth kind of writer. Like, there's no, you know, he's like a journalist by trade rather than by training. If that makes any sense, you know?
Yes.
So yeah,
this is how he would express himself, even if he wasn't a journalist by trade.
Right. And so, like, it's kind of insane what happened to him, and just kind of the institutional forces that are kind of pitted against him. And so, in that way, like I've talked about 2009's Zatoon, the Dave Eggers book, which I really dug and talked about on the show. Which has like a similar story, but it's kind of like in this case anyway. It's kind of like an Inside Out Kafka-esque like novel / story, right? Because at no point are the motives or the actors or the plot against this guy like unknown to him, right? Like right from when he's born, there's like racists on his door, right? Like, they're not sending mixed messages. They're not hiding behind anything. You're a black person. We hate you, you know?
Right.
And then he kills a white woman and confesses. So at no point is there any like confusion around that either.
Right.
And then later he's like everything's always on the table. It's like, you're a prisoner. You're in here for life. We're not letting you out. Right? Like, there's a certain internal logic to everything that happens to him, but he's like, just like some, like, under the covers, arcane, mysterious government conspiracy, it still ends in the same result. Like, he's basically screwed for reasons that are beyond his control, right?
You know what? I don't know when I'm going to find time to read this book, but I really, really want to read this book, and I'll tell you why. I feel like this fills a hole in my prison reading. Because we mentioned right off the top, right? You mentioned Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption, and you mentioned The Green Mile, right? Which are both Stephen King. One's a novella, one's a novel. But they both ultimately, spoilers for people who haven't seen those movies, feature innocent men, right? Tim Robbins' character is innocent, and Michael Clark Duncan's character is innocent. And so at the other end of the spectrum, you also mentioned Oz. I don't know. Have you seen Oz?
I'm not a big Oz watcher, no.
I've seen the first two seasons of Oz, and it's it's people who did the crime and now they're doing the time. The time is horrible. It is. It goes into like what are, because it's an experimental prison, right? So it's you're not just dealing with the characters and their stories, but you're also dealing with, you know, how prisons work and how prisons don't work and the attempts that these people are making to make a better prison, right? That will do a better job of prisoner care and of reform and of, you know, helping to mend these people. But it does it by showing you all of the worst problems and all of the ways in which sometimes even the best intentions can go horribly wrong. And you get to see that, you get to see the kind of people that make people say, we should throw that guy in a hole and throw away the key, right? And then you have to sort of, you know, confront that. It's a tough, tough, tough watch. And I couldn't go past two seasons. It was just psychically like a nail in the head. And then on the journalistic side, I just read a couple of articles actually about prisons. One is called Hellhole, which is by Atul Gawande in The New Yorker.
Oh, the doctor guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's great.
It was fantastic. I mean, even though it was dealing with an incredibly tough subject, it's all about solitary confinement and whether or not solitary confinement is actually torture and whether or not we should just get rid of solitary confinement altogether in the prison system and whether it has any benefits and whatever, and makes a pretty convincing case that solitary confinement is one of the worst kinds of torture that there is. And after even a week in solitary confinement, the human brain starts to change and you lose the ability to think, basically. And even the most intelligent, strong-willed human being will completely break down. When
it's like sensory deprivation, right?
It's like sensory. It's social sensory deprivation, and it just, the effects are just horrific. And so when you then do this to people who already have like borderline personality disorders and these terrible upbringings, and you know, it's horrible. He makes a really, I mean, I haven't read any of the counterarguments to it, right? So obviously he set out to make a case, and he makes it very well, and I was convinced by it, but. So I read that, and then there was an op-ed piece, The Way to Stop Prison Rape, in the New York Review of Books. And so, I mean, that's just sort of one of the givens of prison culture, right? And our modern understanding of prison is that, you know, there's that whole, the Edward Norton film, the Spike Lee film, based on the book by the guy who did Clockers. It's like 25 hours or something like that.
Yep.
And basically, he's, you know, getting ready to go to jail, and his biggest fear going to jail is that he's going to be raped. And this is just sort of, you know, come into our understanding, and maybe, you know, because of the writing this guy was doing in the 70s and the 80s, you know, it's coming into our understanding of what prisons are and how they work. And there's just a lot of research now that shows, the majority of sexual abuse in prisons, or at least a large part of it, is actually between prison officials and prisoners, right? There's an abuse of power there, and how preventable it is, right? And it looks at how the stats for murder in prisons have dropped precipitously, right? So it just explores the possibility of prison reform. So I just think that this book, it sounds like it ties, you know, all of these things together. It's got the interest of the Stephen King stories. It deals with the problems of Oz, and it's got the sort of journalistic viewpoint of these other articles. It really sounds, it's very odd that this is the book that you should choose to talk about, because it sounds like it synthesizes all of these things that I've brushed up again, because I do have an interest in the subject matter. So,
well, yeah. And I guess the one criticism that you can put against it is there's probably a hell of a lot over 44 years that isn't in here.
Right.
Right. So he is very diplomatic about certain things and certain people. And you never, like, I got the sense that I was just like, oh, there's clearly more to that story, and he's holding back, but is he holding back for, like, economy of narrative, or is there really more to that story, right?
Or, I think there probably is more to that story, but maybe the more to that story doesn't touch on the narrative that he's telling, right?
Exactly, exactly. I mean, and
it's prison. People are probably just sitting around telling stories all day long. If he broke them all down, that book would be as long as his life. Like,
for sure, for sure. So anyway, it's a portrait of like institutional oppression, like go enthusiasm, you know. so it gave me, you know, gave me good vibes, and that's my pick.
All right, we'll put one in the win column, man. That's awesome. And that's it for another episode of the Enthusiasticast. As always, we'd love to hear what you're enthusiastic about, either in a comment on the show, post at our website, enthusiasticast.com, or in an email to hello@enthusiasticast.com. And you should know that if you recommend a book to us and we end up talking about your book on the show, we will call you out. We will ask you to send us your mailing details, and we'll send you a copy of your choice of one of the books we've been enthusiastic about. Also, if you're getting the show through iTunes, we'd love for you to leave a review, because that's a great way to help new people find the show. Until next time, I'm John.
And I'm Mark.
Thanks for listening.
Cheers.